This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our online and broadcast Main Street all across North Dakota. And today we'll begin our show with somebody we've talked with before. Anton Troyer is an author and a professor of Ojibwe at Bemidji State University. His new book is a young reader's version of a book he first published for the rest of us in 2012 titled Everything You Wanted to Know About Indians But Were Afraid to Ask. Anton, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Now, my first question to an author is inevitably, why did you write the book? But why did you want to rework your 2012 adult book for young readers?
Oh, you know, I could start first with how I stumbled into this project and then the latest iteration with the youth edition. You know, I think by the time I had finished high school, I actually went to public high school in Bemidji. And my goal was to get out of town and never come back. And for some reason, I thought I was escaping the brambled racial borderland of my youth and kind of naively thought that it would be different in a different place. I got into Princeton University and I thought, oh, this will be great. You know, people will, be far more educated. And I think the first question was something like, hey, dude, where's your tomahawk or something like
that. Oh, man. Wow.
Thinking, these are the dumbest smart people I've ever met. But I had a great experience at college, and there's nothing like leaving home to make you want to come back and never leave. And so I was getting homesick, and at one point I heard there was a Comanche spiritual leader coming to the New Jersey woods near Princeton to run sweat lodge ceremonies. And I remember thinking, you know, there are weirdos and Fruit Loops out there. This could be one. The Comanche are from Oklahoma and Texas. What are they doing in New Jersey? But I was so homesick, I went to check it out. And it was about 4 in the afternoon, and there were about 20 white folk waiting for the sweat lodge ceremony, but they were all completely naked. And yeah, exactly. So part of me, of course, wanted to laugh because, dang, there's 20 naked people standing around in the woods. You know, part of me wanted to run because, dang, there's 20 naked people standing around in the woods. And part of me is getting mad, like, dang, is that what they think we're all about? And then, being naive, I get out of the car, and I'm immediately folded into a tight embrace by one of these naked strangers who's hugging me and saying, I'm so sorry what my people did to your people. So now the feeling is like, word. And the desire to laugh, run, get mad is growing. And I looked at this person's face. She was an elder. There were tears welling up in her eyes. And it occurred to me, no matter how misguided she was, and she was misguided, that her emotional response was sincere. And if I just got mad and told her off, that would be her only experience with a native person. If I walked away, she'd keep thinking what she was thinking. So I had to think fast. And I said, you know, ma'am, could you put some clothes on? Because I would love to talk to you about all of this. And she did. And we actually had a good conversation. And in a weird way, you know, she learned some things, but in a weird way, I did too. You could say I learned something important from a naked stranger in the New Jersey woods, which is that it's important to make safe space, to give people a meaningful answer, not just an angry rebuke. And I started saving the questions, and they always came, you know, terminology. Is it Indian, Native American, Aboriginal, Indigenous, First Nation person, or what? What is tribal sovereignty? What's a naming ceremony? What do you think about mascots? You know, and I just started saving these questions and hunting for answers. I think as a Native person, I got the same sugar-coated version of Chris Columbus in the first Thanksgiving everyone else got too. And so while I knew what it was like living in my skin and having my experience as a Native person, speaking to, you know, Indigenous histories and cultures, that required some work. And so that was the, you know, genesis for the first book. And since then, it really took off. I routinely do about maybe 25 public speaking events a year, so a couple of months. And a lot of them have put me in front of young people. And so the goal with the Young Reader Edition is, first of all, just to speak directly to young people, our future leaders, who are bright and inquisitive and want to help make the world a better place. And also, frankly, since 2012, so much has happened. We had the Dakota Access Pipeline protest. We had that confrontation at the Lincoln Memorial, the Indigenous experience with COVID, lots of things that have really transformed the landscape in Indigenous communities. So the book grew, you know, in terms of the span of questions and topics covered, and I just rewrote everything to speak directly to young people.
Anton Troyer is the author of Everything You Wanted to Know About Indians But Were Afraid to Ask. You can find out lots about his other books and about this issue, this book, at antontroyer.com. Troyer is spelled T-R-E-U-E-R. I was really intrigued by part of the title, Anton, Afraid to Ask. Is this sort of the cultural conflict point here? We want to know, but we're afraid of, you know, insulting somebody?
You know, sometimes it's difficult. Like, I feel like America's on the verge of another attempted racial reckoning. Certainly, you know, what has transpired with the death of George Floyd has galvanized attention about police practices with regard to people of color. And I think it's difficult for a lot of people in places like North Dakota and Minnesota and so forth to navigate this. We're trained to be so conflict averse that we almost become communication averse. We might get a new neighbor and drop off a casserole and then give them their space, you know? And it makes it difficult to lean in and really have important conversations and learning about some of the most important topics of our time. And so I think there is this kind of cultural training to avoid it. But avoiding it doesn't make it go away and it doesn't make things get better. So I do think there's some fear. People are afraid of exposing an ignorance or offending someone or things like that. And so the effort to make safe space, I think, is really critical. Ultimately, we're going to make things better when we can build bridges, connect with one another, learn from one another. Honestly, it's good advice if anyone ever wants to be in a marriage or have a kid or work in a workplace with more than two people as well. But especially if we want to tackle these big topics.
Well, let's talk about some of these big topics. I'll take one from the 2012 version for adults that you referenced in an earlier comment. What are the appropriate and inappropriate terms for talking about North America's first people?
Yeah, ultimately, we don't have universal agreement about terminology, which is frustrating and confusing sometimes. We've seen this happen in the Black community, too, where some people will insist on Black and others African-American, not colored people, but sometimes people of color in order to be more inclusive. And the same stuff has gone on in the Indigenous community, where some groups have doubled down on American Indian, like even the American Indian Movement or the National Congress of American Indians. Others, like the Native American Rights Fund, have said this is the preferred label. And it's confusing for everyone. So I think as a general rule of thumb for everybody listening today, you know, Native American and Indigenous are pretty politically correct. No one's going to get upset with you for using those, even though sometimes they're a little bit ambiguous. You know, if I say, you know, a Fargo Native, does that mean a Native American from Fargo or someone born and bred? So you end up having to use some more syllables to make it clear. I'd love for us to do what they did in Canada, where they had a big national conversation, and there they agreed on First Nation. So instead of reserves, they call them First Nations, and instead of Indians or Aboriginals, they call them First Nations people. And a couple syllables, everybody knows who you're talking about. It's clear. Everyone can pronounce it. Perfect, you know, but we haven't gotten there yet. So I tend to use them all somewhat interchangeably, aware of their shortcomings as a means of making safe space. But if you happen to be working at a school or a program or an office and they're trying to figure out what to do, I usually say just engage the Indigenous people in your community. Especially if you're at a school and there's a native parent committee or something like that, there's a way to do that. And then if anybody gives you grief about the label you picked, you can say, well, our native stakeholders said to use this, and we'll take your comments. We revisit the conversation annually, and we'll take them into consideration when we have our next discussion. And it gets you a get out of getting beat up around the ears card, as well as a way to be responsive to your native community.
Another question from your adult version of this book, Everything You Wanted to Know About Indians But Were Afraid to Ask. You just referred to this. Do Indigenous people in Canada, First Nations, get treated better by their government than those in the U.S.?
It's just different. I wouldn't say anybody's got it better or worse. That, you know, in the United States, the status of tribes as sovereign nations is actually stronger than it is in Canada. But the difference is, you know, to be a sovereign nation recognized by the federal government in the United States, you have to have a treaty with the U.S. government. And a lot of tribes actually lost their land dealing with the French or the British or the Russians, as happened in Alaska and so forth. And they're not even considered legally recognized. In Canada, rather than an inherent sovereignty, you know, the status of tribes is something that's usually gone through the Canadian Parliament. But it really varies. You know, the Canadians had to deal with the French and the British and the Russians, but they didn't have to deal with a new colonial wave like in America with the Americans. And so I would say there's been colonization and oppression in both places. About 80% of the population in Canada lives within 50 miles of the U.S. border. A lot of people don't know that in the U.S. And so as you go further north, there are big chunks of territory where it's the population's primarily Indigenous. And so there's a little more strength of language and culture in some parts of Canada, but certainly not all. And right now, you know, I would say the Canadian government has engaged in a truth and reconciliation process that is kind of focused around Indigenous people brought to residential boarding schools and forced to endure a forced assimilation policy that was really devastating. And the Canadian government determined that the Canadian government had engaged in cultural genocide. So there's been an effort at reconciliation, but there are still huge issues in places like Canada. Even around, ironically, getting clean drinking water in tribal communities, even the ones that are sometimes quite isolated because of infrastructure developments and things like that. So I think the Canadian Indigenous people would not say we've got it better, you know, and I don't think the Americans would either. But at the same time, I think there has been progress in both places, and there's tons more to do in both.
From your new book, the version for young readers, a really intriguing question. What's it like for natives who don't look native?
Well, that is the case for a lot of people in Indigenous communities today. The native population actually has one of the highest rates of marriage to people outside of their racial group. And lots of native people may look white, look black, look brown, or look racially ambiguous. And so the experience really varies a bit. I think, you know, in dealing with the rest of the world, a lot of times people, you know, their first impression is based upon color. So sometimes we experience hypervisibility when we look brown or black. But then also we often experience invisibility if we don't look the stereotypical part. And a lot of, you know, like white passing Native people, Native Americans who look white, might sometimes be doubted in their authenticity by their own people, which can be another special kind of pain, and may be doubted by the rest of the world for their, you know, true indigeneity. So I would say the identity landscape and just the emotional fallout from that can be difficult and troubling sometimes.
Anton Troyer is the author of Everything You Wanted to Know About Indians But Were Afraid to Ask, and we're talking about his new version of this book for young readers. The book was published for the rest of us in 2012. And there's a question that is posed in that original version of the book that's related to what we just talked about in the youth version. What is blood quantum? What is tribal enrollment? How are they related?
Right. So I would say every racial minority group has some sort of internal discussion about pedigree, and there's kind of a color line, and people get treated differently depending upon how dark they are and so forth. But it's further complicated in indigenous communities, because most of the tribes in the United States require that a person prove a percentage of blood that comes from that particular group in order to be eligible for citizenship as a member of the tribe. And that's the tribal enrollment. And so it's a hot button topic within indigenous communities, because in some places, you could even take somebody who's 100% genetically Native American, but if their four grandparents each came from four different Native communities, they might only be enrolled as 25%. And if they marry somebody, outside of that community, their children wouldn't even be eligible for tribal enrollment. So it's kind of an old genetics issue, kind of like Nazi science, really, designed to have us breed ourselves out of existence. And in my opinion, I think we should do away with blood quantum as the measure for tribal enrollment. But not everybody sees it that way. I think one of the concerns that some Native people have is if you open up, and pick a different criteria for tribal enrollment, we'll be enrolling lots of people, who've lived outside of Native communities for a long time. Those political ideas will, overwhelm the agenda for tribes. There's competition for resources, even scholarship money and things like that. And so those are some of the fears they have. And I think that's easily enough mitigated by having a strong residency requirement for people who hold tribal office, or things like that. But ultimately, the politics of exclusion and people fighting to keep their grandkids off of the tribal rolls is just really unhealthy and sick. It is changing, and it's difficult to change because it involves constitutional reforms. And imagine how touchy Americans would be if we ripped up the Constitution and made a new one. it's like that for Indigenous people when it comes to restructuring tribal governments. But many of them have done it just this year, or just actually 2 years ago now. Red Lake changed their criteria for tribal enrollment and expanded their roles. There have actually been quite a few people who were added to the roles. Other places have done so as well. And I think that will be the pattern to move in that direction. But it is contested and it is complex.
Will it ever get to the point that would be similar and analogous to citizenship? I mean, I can move to another country and become a citizen of that country. Can I? Might I someday be able to become a citizen or a person of a reservation or a band or a tribal group?
I'm not sure it's going to go quite there. Like, to be a citizen of the United States, if you're born here, you're eligible for citizenship.
Yes.
And if you move here, there's a process by which you can apply for citizenship. And it's not the same for tribes because, if they open that up to people who are not indigenous, then it's the function of a tribe as an indigenous nation and an indigenous community that serves indigenous people can easily be overwhelmed. And if you look like at the Leech Lake Reservation, Native people only own 4% of the land inside their own reservation. At White Earth, Natives own 9% of the land within their own reservation. So if you just went to residency, pretty soon you'd have non-Native people running tribes. So I really doubt it's going to move in that direction. But I do think there will be a movement to, be more inclusive of those who are right now labeled descendants, who are not eligible for enrollment but have Indigenous heritage. They descend from one of the original members. So I think some of the, at least many of the tribes are going to move in that direction. And those who don't are likely to have declining enrollments and less political and economic clout as they, struggle to affirm and maintain their sovereignty and the function of their governments.
From your young reader's version, a question inquiring minds want to know, and this one is another good one. Why is it called a traditional Indian fry bread taco?
It's one of the great mysteries of the universe, Doug. Those words don't even sound like they should belong in the same sentence. But here's what it was, as at the start of the treaty period, in the middle of the 1800s, Native people were forced to consolidate their populations onto smaller portions of their land. And so there just wasn't as much. There just wasn't as much buffalo to access, wild rice to harvest. We had fewer resources. The government gave rations of lard and flour, and people figured out how to make food out of that. And you got fry bread. And it ultimately became something that people were used to eating, kind of culturally. And so, it's very common that there's fry bread served with, a native meal really throughout the plains, the Great Lakes, even in the Southwest, and so forth. But it wouldn't be in any pre-contact Indigenous diet. And, I guess for myself, I can be a sucker for one of those fry bread tacos myself because they are yummy. But at the same time, with the highest rate of diabetes for any racial group in this country, we have to be really careful about what we center. And to me, I think decolonizing our diet and upholding our traditional foods, for example, things like wild rice, wild game that is, smoked, roasted, or boiled rather than fried, fish, berries, things like that, like it's all good for you. And it was just amazing when I was researching and writing for the Warrior Nation book, which is a history of Red Lake, how many people lived well into their 90s, or Noden Wind, who lived, was born in 1874 and dies in 1981. He was a grand marshal for the 4th of July parade in Bemidji and had lived through half of America's first 200 years, and that was before smallpox vaccines and all of that, because people had healthy lifestyles and ate healthy food. So I think without beating people up or shaming them for the fry that everybody's grandma cooks, it's time to think about what is traditional in terms of our food.
Anton Troyer is the author of Everything You Wanted to Know About Indians But Were Afraid to Ask. It was first released in 2012 by the Minnesota Historical Society Press. There's a new version for young readers. Anton is also a professor of Ojibwe at Bemidji State University. You can find out more about what he does and his books at antontroyer.com. Anton, it's always a pleasure to talk with you.
Likewise, Doug. Thanks so much for having me on. I always appreciate our conversations.
Coming up on Main Street, North Dakota's number one summer destination had a close call last week. We'll talk with the new executive director of the Medora Convention and Visitors Bureau after the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The House has killed a bill that would have allowed the legislature to meet in a short session in the even-numbered years. As the Senate amended Senate Bill 2218, it would try a one-time short session to see if it would work. Supporters say it was partially born out of frustration with the legislature not having much of a say in how federal CARES Act money was spent. That decision was in the hands of the state's Emergency Commission and the legislature's budget section. Rugby Republican Representative John Nelson was a supporter.
Arguably, not every issue would get chosen, but the priority issues that we feel are that are most necessary to be addressed by the legislature could be in this smaller session.
But Fargo Republican Representative Jim Casper, the chairman of the House Government and Veterans Affairs Committee, said his committee is working on amendments to another bill that would require a special session to deal with special funding from the federal government.
That after a certain level of spending, The governor would have to call us into session to spend any more money. So that's in the works. So we don't really need to look at this bill, I do not believe, to work on us having a voice, because I agree we should have had a voice for the last year about how the money was spent.
The measure failed 68 to 25. Minnesota Governor Tim Walz's administration is pushing back against a state Senate GOP plan to cut operational spending in state agencies. The cuts were part of a state government finance bill presented in a Senate committee hearing. State Revenue Commissioner Robert Doty told lawmakers the proposed 5% reduction over the next 2 years would hurt his agency.
The department cannot absorb the appropriation reduction and needs an operating increase to maintain our current service levels. The reduction in funds equates to reduction in staffing of about 90 employees.
Senators plan to discuss that bill during a hearing later today. And the legislature is considering moving the management of the Lewis and Clark Interpretive Center at Washburn from the State Parks and Recreation Department to the State Historical Society. That would include the Fort Mandan site. The Senate already approved it as part of the Parks and Recreation budget. Here's Fargo Republican Senator Ron Sorvag.
It fits more in the mission, the description of the mission of the Interpretive Center with the Historical Society. So that is the feeling. It transfers, obviously, all the income responsibilities that they get. And it really wasn't easy as far as employees, because the Park District had 3.75 employees, but that was their only job.
Sorvag says those employees would also transfer to the Historical Society. The budget now goes back to the House. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
I'm Dave Thompson. On this week's Legislative Review, we'll talk with Bismarck Republican Representative Mike Nafee about investing legacy fund income into the state of North Dakota. Also, the bonding bill and how things stand as the legislature goes to its home stretch. Legislative Review is 6:30 p.m. Friday on Prairie Public's radio service, as well as on our digital platforms.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and I'm joined now by Maria Miller. She is the new, relatively new, executive director at the Medora Convention and Visitors Bureau. She moved there in June of last year when it was a different season entirely, a pandemic season. Maria, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
We're going to talk about the upcoming tourist season at North Dakota's principal tourist attraction for the summer. But first of all, let's talk about the close call that Medora had last week with that wildfire. Where were you?
I was not in Medora during the wildfire, but as you can imagine, I did receive several phone calls and video footage and photos kind of as it was happening and watched it on social media, probably like everyone else did. And we were incredibly fortunate, and it was the effort of a lot of community members, people coming in from the region, around the state, to contain that fire and preserve our beautiful historic town.
Well, how close did it get to disaster? I've seen some photos. It looked like it got very close to the amphitheater where the Medora musical is performed.
It does look like it got close to the amphitheater, but fortunately, the amphitheater is intact, still looks beautiful, and is ready for tourists this season.
I noticed also, since I've been to Medora, that there is a Billings Volunteer Fire Department station right in Medora, so that must have been a handy location.
Yes, that was wonderful, and a lot of the community volunteer firefighters came out, fought the fire, and I know several of them didn't sleep for days or slept a couple hours. And now that the fire is out, they're getting some much needed rest. And I don't think words could describe the appreciation of everybody in the region and throughout the community for their hard work.
Well, Medora is right next to another big tourist attraction in North Dakota. That's the Theodore Roosevelt National Park. And there is a fire now in the north unit. So it's just a testament of how dry and perhaps hazardous things are in that part of the state.
It is. We are lucky the south unit is still looking beautiful and is open right now as well. And hopefully all those efforts can help contain the fire in the north unit as well.
Do you know of anything that's being done to decrease the threat to the town this summer? Are they, you know, digging fire pits or doing anything like that to keep this threat at bay?
I am not sure. That would be a great question maybe for the National Park or the Forestry Service, but I know that I'm sure they're having several meetings and conversations post this wildfire. And again, I know that several firefighters were spraying down the roof of the chateau in town to help prevent it from getting there and containing it. And again, that wonderful historic landmark has been preserved.
You came to Medora from Kansas City when you moved in June of last year. How well is Medora known outside of North Dakota?
So that is definitely one of the things that I've been really trying to work on the last year and want to continue to know, because I think outside of the region, it isn't that well known. And I think it is such a magical, beautiful place that story needs to be told and the history. I've been doing a lot of outside sales. I've been attending a lot of group tour and meetings markets that are still happening even during the pandemic. I think getting in front of those tour operators and those small market meetings right now, letting them know who, not only who we are, but that we're here and we're open and we're ready for them to visit is really important. I found out about Medora because I happened to attend a Midwest Travel Network conference. It's a group of travel writers, social media influencers, and DMOs and CVBs throughout the Midwest region. And they put a bid in and Medora won the bid. And so it brought people like me there to be able to experience it for the first time. And it had such an impact on me that a year later, I ended up moving there and taking this position.
Well, you mentioned the pandemic, which certainly disrupted life as usual last year everywhere, including Medora. How significant was the impact on that on the town?
Sure. So our convention and visitors bureaus are funded predominantly by hotel, motel, lodging tax. So just like everyone else throughout the country, ours was down. But what I think really helped not only Medora, but North Dakota as a whole, is that we checked the box for what people were looking for when they were ready to get out of their homes or when they wanted to kind of get out a little bit. It really was the Great American Road Trip. Our campgrounds saw record numbers. Again, our hotels might have been down, but not in comparison to the rest of the country. And people wanting to get in their cars and drive. There was a lot of, I'll get to that someday. I'll go visit all the national parks someday. Or I'll go to the states I've never been to someday. We started seeing that throughout the pandemic. And I really think that's going to continue to move forward through the summer as well. So I think we stand in a really good spot this summer for getting not only returning visitors, where it is generational family tradition, but getting new visitors as well.
Now, a number of the attractions at Medora are operated by the Medora organization, and some are independent vendors. Were any of these businesses closed or affected by the pandemic, and for that matter, not reopening this summer?
Sure. From what I understand, you know, there was a couple that when the state asked to, or when we were in certain colors, you know, they did some social distancing or they closed for a couple weeks, but they really all worked hard to be able to stay open as best as they could. And when I arrived in June, businesses were open. And as far as I know, this summer, they're going to open and maybe even a little bit more hours than they had last summer. I think staffing is always an issue during the pandemic, you know, trying to get help that otherwise they maybe couldn't get last year. But I mean, it was remarkable. Just you see a town with a small number of year-round residents that are really able to pull together and collaborate and work hard, not only all year, but in a very short amount of time. It's really remarkable, and I'm very excited and anxious for this summer.
Well, you mentioned staffing, and I know that a lot of the staff that work at Medora in the summer are from all over the country, and for that matter, all around the world. So is that a concern, recruiting staff for this season?
I think everybody is still, you know, always looking for staff. I know that there's a lot of international students or international employees. And so that's been a little bit difficult, I think, in the hospitality industry around the country, being able to secure some of those people that they normally would be able to. But really what makes Medora unique as well is that with places like the foundation or the independently owned businesses, they offer housing if they can, or assist with housing. A foundation has a meal plan. So I think there's a lot of great benefits. Not only do you get to be in this beautiful, magical place, but all the businesses, foundation and otherwise, are really able to offer great benefits to get employees out for the season.
What about the Medora musical? I mean, it seats thousands. Will it be seating thousands this summer?
Yeah, that's also a great question. I know that they are still, planning on opening the musical and running the musical starting that second week in June. I have not talked to them in terms of how many numbers of seating they will do, but last year they social distanced in between groups and it worked really well. And I'm not sure if that's something they're going to be doing this year. I imagine they'll just be following whatever the state mandates are.
Masks have been very controversial in North Dakota and elsewhere around the country and perhaps the world. But
think we're all still navigating it together.
Yeah, I think so too. But nevertheless, there are people who run businesses and they may want to, protect their employees or themselves or that kind of thing. So is there a policy in Medora, aside from whatever the legislature might decide?
Not outside of what the legislator might decide. And I know a lot of businesses have just been taking their own initiatives of what they're comfortable with. So, throughout last summer and the year, some of the businesses ask that you have a mask on when you enter their business. Some of them will say a mask until you're seated. Some, they'll have their staff wear it, but not the patrons. So I really just think it's been up to the individual businesses thus far. And we were really fortunate. I think last summer, and we were able to open. We had people in town, businesses were able to stay opened. And with the vaccines and everything that's happening in the next few months, I just really think people are getting more comfortable getting out. And I think that will help bring more tourism. And obviously Medora is this beautiful wide open space. So you can socially distance and still be able to attend events and go see the national park and go explore the new hiking trails or the new mini golf course and use your discretion when going to restaurants and stores.
If there hadn't been a pandemic, how many visitors would you expect in Medora during a typical season?
Yeah, from what I understand, we see just throughout a year easily over 1 million visitors. Wow. Between the town and the park combined. Yeah.
Is that the objective this year?
I think we all, as many visitors as we can get, I think we would love. It's always nice when you can hear the campgrounds are full and the hotels are full. And I know last summer we did have some great weekends. We had campgrounds that were full and there were some nights where hotels were full. And obviously we would love to see that every day.
How would you compare the attendance of people who are from North Dakota who are just seeing the state's big attraction, Medora, and compared with the number of people from outside the state? We were talking about how well-known Medora is outside the boundary of North Dakota. What's the breakdown?
Sure. And again, as I mentioned, I think for me, it really is trying to get Medora known outside of the state and outside of the region. And outside sales is something that I really want to push in my time in this position, and that I've been trying to push in the last year that I've been in this position. Also, I think with everything that's happened with the pandemic is people are doing a lot more planning. So you're seeing more people on social media sites, on websites. I know the North Dakota Tourism website has seen record numbers over the last several months from people visiting it and people making plans. So I think, and with the travel writers and social media influencers that have been in town or that we're partnering with or that the foundation is partnering with, it's really spreading the word in a way that maybe it wouldn't have before, because people have become so much more dependent on digital channels or podcasts or radio or things like that to get their information. Last summer, I saw in the office people from all over the country. Again, it was people getting in their cars and driving. So I met people that had been driving from Washington, D.C., or driving from California. But I think it's definitely majority of North Dakota. You get a lot of Minnesota, Montana. But it was pretty remarkable to see the amount of diversity that was in the town last summer. And I really just hope to experience that again this summer. But, you know, several businesses have their little maps in their offices and people stick their pins in. And you will see almost, if not every state represented by the end of the season in that map.
Well, in the interest of boosting attention of potential visitors to Medora, are there incentives being offered? Any lures that are being thrown out there that might attract people who are on the fence?
Yeah, so I know the foundation is really great about having different online specials to purchase tickets to their different events. They also are really great about, you know, Veterans Day and celebrating different people through different initiatives through their website and through their events. The National Park also has several free days at our National Park and all the national parks to recognize pivotal points throughout history, and that's wonderful. You know, we're doing, as a CVB, we're trying to offer more in terms of like an Instagram meetup, you know, where you can come and get kind of a behind-the-scenes look at some different things in the community if you participate in an Instagram meetup and share photos. We're participating in a couple virtual familiarization tours. And if you attend the virtual familiarization tour, you get a discount on a musical ticket. So we're really trying to get more into the digital advertising and to kind of give people a peek so then they'll want to get in their car or feel comfortable getting on a plane and coming to visit us once they see all of that.
You've mentioned the foundation and, of course, the adjacent national park. Do you work together? Do you kind of get together and talk about objectives and potential and all that kind of thing?
Yeah, absolutely. And we're actually pretty excited. In June, we're having a community barbecue kickoff, and it's a joint effort between the Convention and Visitors Bureau, the foundation, and our local Chamber of Commerce, because we realize the importance of hospitality and tourism. It's the reason our community exists. And, you know, working together to kind of talk about events and plan activities and how we can collaborate is incredibly important, especially when you live in such a small community that sees as many tourists as we do. So I think the saying is right about a rising tide. So it lifts all boats. So the more we can work together and rise, the more we can do that. And now more than ever, I think that's really important. And, you know, for a community of our size to have the amount of museums and attractions and restaurants and retail stores and events is really remarkable.
Well, the Theodore Roosevelt Presidential Library is in play. That'll be another huge attraction in your neighborhood, but it's a while off yet. In the meantime, the tourist season for Medora, pretty much any place at this latitude, is shorter than other places. Is there any planning about, pushing the edges there, doing winter activities or other times of the year just to get people more interested in going to this destination outside of summer?
Absolutely. We know that as a community, there's lots of ways that we can collaborate more for shoulder seasons, you know, spring, fall, and even into winter. And this last winter, a lot of businesses did choose to stay open. A couple of the attractions had events this winter and all proved to be very successful. And so we're definitely all trying to collaborate and work on some more initiatives for the shoulder seasons. And of course, the park is absolutely beautiful. If people haven't seen it in the fall, it's really breathtaking. Same with the spring. I think we're really fortunate that we get a fall and a spring and a summer along with the winter that we can enjoy. And we've got a lot of great things planned coming up in the next month through the winter. So we're pretty excited. I think, we have our wine walk, which is May 1st. So that's kind of going to be a big kickoff. And then we move into, we are having our bluegrass and barbecue event the following weekend, and then it's just going to be a jam-packed summer from there.
Well, you moved in June of last year from Kansas City, a much bigger city. Do you live in Medora or do you commute? That's a small town.
It's a small town. I do live in Medora. I am a North Dakota Medora resident. I spent some time this winter working remotely, but also attending a lot of conferences. There was a lot of virtual conferences, but several travel planning organizations, Select Travel, Small Meetings Market, Group Travel Family, all of those were still happening this year. And again, as I mentioned, being in front of those people is more important now than ever, because if they're willing to still meet about bringing their bus groups, or they still want to have their meetings, they want to say, hey, who's open? Who can accommodate my group? And who is also making an effort to be here in front of me? And that's really going to set us apart, I think, because these groups plan not 6 months out, not just a year out, but 2-3 years out. And so we've also been able to already start talking about the library, which is projected to open in 2025. And there are people that want to plan their bus groups and start putting those together around that opening. And several that are excited to come out before that. And we're just, and the event space that we have, we're perfect for small meetings, reunions, weddings. It's really, it checks a lot of what people are looking for right now, that want the wide open spaces, that want to have the amount of museums and attractions. We're incredibly lucky, between all the foundation attractions and shows, but we also have so much retail and the North Dakota Cowboy Hall of Fame and the Chateau State Historic Site, which has events every weekend. There's something for everybody, every hobby, every interest, every age, to keep you busy for days.
And when does the Medora tourist season start?
Well, we like to think that we're a tourist season all year, in terms of having something to offer. But really, when all of the shows and everything start taking place, that is going to be, June 1st, the Teddy Theodore Roosevelt show opens at Old Town Hall Theater. And then the musical starts that following week, along with the gospel brunch. And I know the foundation is introducing a couple new children's shows this year, along with, I believe, that Great American Folk Show there this year. So that'll be really exciting.
Well, that's a Prairie Public production. So
yeah,
we're happy
is.
To hear
so
about that.
Yeah, we're excited. And they've been incredibly helpful in helping us connect with some bands for the bluegrass and barbecue event. So just to have people be able to come out and experience live music and walk around town, it's really going to be wonderful.
Maria Miller is the executive director of the Medora Convention and Visitors Bureau. Thanks for being with us today, Maria.
Thank you for having me.
Dakota Datebook is next.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative, headquartered in Bismarck, a Touchstone energy cooperative generating and delivering electricity to over 3 million consumers in 9 states, spanning from the Canadian to Mexican border.
This is Dakota Datebook for April 7th. The Mexican Civil War erupted in 1910. For the most part, the violence remained south of the Rio Grande. But when the United States pulled their support from Mexican revolutionary Francisco Pancho Villa, he felt betrayed. So in the pre-dawn hours of March 9th, 1916, Villa led a column of guerrillas across the border into the small town of Columbus, New Mexico. They left the town in flames, with 17 Americans dead. Word of the attack raced across the nation's telegraphs. Newspaper headlines called for immediate action. Brigadier General John J. Pershing would lead troops across the border in pursuit of Villa. At the same time, President Wilson called out 112,000 National Guardsmen for border service. They would act as a show of force to prevent further raids. Among them were 1,000 men of the 1st North Dakota Infantry National Guard. They were sent to Mercedes, a small town in Hidalgo County, Texas, about 7 miles from the Rio Grande.
Over the next 8 months, their days were spent drilling, marching, and as one guardsman noted, "We have guard duty and plenty of it." They would battle tarantulas, scorpions, obscene heat, wind, rain, and mosquitoes. But not all was bad. Most evenings were spent listening to bands from the various regiments, playing ball games, or fishing in the Rio Grande. While the North Dakota Guardsmen saw no real action during their time in Texas, the experience would prove valuable. The training they received would be put to good use later that year when the United States declared war on Germany. By January of 1917, the punitive expedition withdrew, having been unsuccessful in the hunt for Pancho Villa. The National Guard units were also sent home. As the North Dakota Guardsmen prepared to depart, they were given written testimonials of thanks from the citizens of Mercedes, one of which read, "The citizens of Mercedes, having been witness of your daily drill, your fidelity to work, your soldierly qualities and manly bearing under the restraint of inaction, desire to compliment you on these facts and desire to congratulate your governor and the people of your home state upon the splendid military efficiency you have shown under circumstances most exacting." 43 years later, on this date in 1960, a historical marker was erected near the town of Mercedes in further recognition of the men from North Dakota. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Christina Campbell. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
On Prairie Public Primetime TV tonight...
On Hemingway. Whatever happened to him now, he considered of no importance, as long as he could write.
World War II leaves lasting scars.
He had seen so many things that he could not unsee.
A classic masterpiece.
Everything about him was old, except his eyes.
And a descent into darkness.
The history of mental illness in the family had to be on his mind.
Don't miss the final chapter of Hemingway.
Watch the third and final part of Ken Burns' Hemingway tonight at 7 Central, 6 Mountain on Prairie Public.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
Thanks for listening today to Main Street. As you may know, as we broadcast, we stream online at prairiepublic.org. And after the broadcast or online stream, you can find any Main Street show as a podcast at prairiepublic.org. Thursday on our show, a statewide survey offers insights into attitudes and behaviors related to the pandemic. And we'll discuss the results with University of North Dakota professors Jason Jensen and David Flynn. Northern border security isn't something we often think about. We'll talk about a shortage of resources due to the surge of refugees at the southern border with Burke County Sheriff Sean Breen. And Sue Balcom will drop by for Main Street Eats. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Thursday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.